The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Are you looking for more customers for your business? Are you facing new competitors, not just across town, but across the country? How about across borders? How about worldwide? Welcome to Global Reach with your host, Tay Revez. As new technology makes it easier to connect with your customers, it also makes it easier for international competitors to reach them. Our program will help you stay competitive in a tough marketplace. Now, here's your host, Tay Revez.
Welcome back to Global Reach, everyone. This is a show that helps your business deal with opportunities, risks, and strategies in the global marketplace. And this week, it's a lot about risk, cyber theft, and cybersecurity. You've all been reading, hackers linked to Chinese military cyber command have reportedly engaged in a massive theft of intellectual property from U.S. companies. At the same time, they've been probing for weaknesses in the U.S. digital infrastructure, in its energy grid, its telecom. Representative Mike Rogers of Michigan, who's the chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, and the ranking Democratic member, Dutch Ruppersberger, wrote that China has stolen from U.S. companies the amount of intellectual property equal to 50 times the current print collection of the Library of Congress. No longer just a cost of doing business in China, China is trying to steal U.S. prosperity. So is this stage one in the world's first cyber war? Or, as my guest, Anup Ghosh, president and founder of Invincia, says, an unprecedented state-sanctioned trade war. He's going to be joined by economist, thought leader Alan Tunnelson of the U.S. Business and Industrial Council Foundation. And they're going to talk about the impact of the big hack attack on strength, competitiveness of U.S. and Chinese economy, on their respective national security, on international power. How should the U.S. respond? How should U.S. companies respond? Are other companies getting hit? What are the dangers of escalation? We've got a lot on our plate today, and this is all really critical stuff. Before we go on, first of all, welcome. Anup, welcome to Global Reach.
Thank you very much, Tay.
And Alan, welcome back.
Great to be here, Tay.
You were on with a great interview when we did the program called It's Manufacturing Stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Before we go on to the meat of the subject, let me tell you a little bit more about our guests. Alan is the editor of the American Economic Alert. He's a research fellow at the U.S. Business and Industrial Council Educational Foundation, which is a Washington research organization that studies U.S. economic, technology, and national security policy. His book, Race to the Bottom, Why a Global Worker Surplus and Uncontrolled Free Trade are Sinking American Living Standards, was recently published by Westview Press. He has written articles on American politics, foreign policy, globalization, technology policy. They've appeared in everything from The Atlantic to Foreign Affairs to The New York Times, Harvard Business Review, New Republic, Foreign Policy. In addition, Alan has appeared on radio and television, Jim Lehrer's NewsHour, CNN, Global Economic Media. He's also the author of Made in China, America's Failed Trade Policies Towards the People's Republic, and Giving America the Business Roundtable's Shoddy Case for Corporate-Driven Trade Policies. So he is a perfect person to be on this show. Dr. Anup Ghosh is the founder and CEO at Invincia, which is a cybersecurity company with world clients. Prior to founding Invincia, Dr. Ghosh was program manager at the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, DARPA, where he created and managed an extensive portfolio of cybersecurity programs. He has previously held roles as chief scientist in the Center for Secure Information Systems at George Mason University, and is Vice President of Research at Cigital. Amip has published more than 40 peer-reviewed articles in cybersecurity journals. He is also a frequent contributor to CNN, CNBC, NPR, and Bloomberg TV. So Global Reach is incredibly lucky that he was able to come on the show. He's also had commentaries in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Ford, Associated Press, Fox News, U.S. Today. He was awarded the NSA's Frank Rowlett Trophy for individual contributions in 2005 and the Secretary of Defense Medal for Exceptional Public Service for his contributions while at DARPA. He's on the Naval Studies Board and the Air Force Scientific Advisory Board. So, wow, could we have anybody better to tell you how to protect yourself from the big hack attack? Okay, gentlemen, let's plunge in. What's China's real motive here? Is it the first step in an international war? Are we talking trade war? Anna.
I hate to get bogged down in semantics about whether it's a trade war or a more conventional war or a cyber war. Clearly, there is a major Chinese cyber offensive that's been taking place recently. There's no doubt that it's targeting critical U.S. government and also private sector institutions, ranging from as you mentioned in your introduction, critical American infrastructure to American media companies to U.S. government websites of to U.S. government sites and installations of all kinds. The question is not to figure out what label to put on this. The question is to figure out what to do about this. And there have been any number of proposals that have been set forth by President Obama, by various members of Congress's Joint Intelligence Committee, that I think represent useful steps here. But
let's get into that in a little bit. I really think the why is important because...
Oh, the why is. I'm just saying the label really isn't.
Okay.
The why is, I think the Chinese clearly want to appropriate as many American technology and commercial secrets as they possibly can to jumpstart and speed up their own economic and technology development. But I think they're also trying to send the U.S. Political leadership and U.S. military a very pointed message, which is that even though by most measures of conventional military strength we remain vastly inferior to you, if push comes to shove, if tensions really do flare, we can inflict significant damage on you through these new cyber capabilities.
Okay.
So you should be very careful about dealing forcefully with us.
That was Alan, right?
Yes.
Right. Dr. Gush, because I think your names sound alike
over the thing.
Do you agree? Because
yes,
called this the first step in an unprecedented state-sponsored trade war.
I do, and I've been using the terminology carefully because I think labels do have consequences. And what we're seeing coming out of Washington right now is a lot of saber-rattling with this terminology cyber war. I used to work for the Department of Defense, and war is actually a full-spectrum engagement with our adversaries that includes, obviously, kinetic weapons like missiles all the way through cyber exploitation and attack. And the reality is when we commit ourselves to a war, we don't necessarily draw boundaries around these. Really, everything is on the table, and the question is really what's the most effective means at achieving the objective. So part of the reason why I differentiate what's going on in terms of the activities, I fully agree with what Alan said is going on as far as sort of a transfer of intellectual property from our country to China, among others, is it's not really war. It's trade war. And the reason why I make that distinction is because it matters for how we do policy going forward. You know, when when you talk to politicians, and of course politicians at the end of the day formulate policy and determine government spend and priorities, it's important to speak in terminology they understand. In this case, when you start talking anything cyber, oftentimes the eyes glaze over. It's a space they're uncomfortable talking about. On the other hand, we start talking about jobs. You start talking about loss of industries from the U.S. to overseas, to China, and sort of a systematic pillaging of our intellectual property, whose very design is to enable industries within their own borders to compete and eventually outcompete the U.S., then it really is speaking in terms that policymakers can understand and begin to act on. And when you consider what's going on as far as cyber breaches and understand, most of it is aimed at grabbing intellectual property and enabling technology transfer illicitly. There is a range of policy mechanisms that come into play when you think of it as a trade war.
Hold on to that for a second.
Sure.
But I think in terms of what you're saying, if you look at some of the things that have been targeted, five multinational oil and gas companies, U.S. telecom infrastructure. It was very interesting. One of the, I think it was a CNN commentator, was going, well, there's intellectual property, but boy, when it comes to national security, and all I could think of was, intellectual property is national security. Now, human capital, intellectual capital, is going to determine relative power as well as relative economic strength.
Well, there's no question about that, and I certainly agree that the more purely economic aspects of China's cyber campaign are critically important. I would be the last person to underestimate the imperative for the U.S. economy to remain as strong and as technologically proficient as it possibly can, especially vis-a-vis foreign competitors whose long-term objectives, like China's, we really can't be too certain about. However, I would also emphasize that there are more purely military slash security implications that we need to recognize and respond to as well. I'm thinking particularly of the tenet of Chinese strategic thought that has become extremely popular, especially in the last 20 years or so, as the Chinese have witnessed one after another overwhelming show of U.S. military technological superiority in the first Persian Gulf War, in Afghanistan, even in Iraq, and the present drone strikes have made a huge impression on Chinese military thinkers, who understand that they are nowhere close to developing capabilities like these and are in fact vulnerable to them. But the Chinese also recognize that one of the very distinctive and very exciting from their standpoint characteristics of the new digital technologies is the ability to give militarily inferior competitors very potent counterweapons. And that's why I said they're really intent on sending us this message that if tensions flare over the Taiwan Straits, for example, we can hurt you significantly, so you had better be careful about throwing your weight around.
Anup, do you agree? You're the one who's embedded in our defense establishment, or at least you're in touch with them. Do you agree with that analysis?
So there definitely are border lines that need to be drawn, and there's definitely a case for when cyber war needs to be brought to bear. The important distinction, though, is to understand what is going on is trade war, that it's actually economic espionage that's currently going on. So it shouldn't be confused with actions of war. Just to give you an example, recently the Office of the Director of National Intelligence produced a national intelligence estimate. This is a document briefed to Congress about threats. And in this case, it was about the China threat in cyber. And they estimated that the breaches from China is reducing U.S. gross domestic product by as much as $100 billion per year. So this isn't a particular industry group with an agenda. It's a national intelligence estimate that is then used to help formulate government policy. But to your point, Tay, I think you were spot on that, in fact, the economic prosperity is the linchpin of our national security. Mm-hmm. In other words, we do not have national security without economic prosperity. And again, when we start to put what's going on in the cyber world in terms of jobs and industries, I think we can begin to formulate the proper response to these cyber threats.
You know, we've got about 3 minutes to break, probably 2.5. Let's start talking. Let me just pose one quick thing. The Chinese military has a huge involvement, huge shareholder stake in their military-industrial complex. It's, you know, they own a lot of businesses. How much are they motivated, real quick, by feathering their own nest?
Well, so Mandiant recently put out a report, I guess it's almost 3 weeks now, that talked about a particular military unit of the Chinese PLA that does nothing but focus on cyber breach and exploitation. And the point of putting out the report was essentially they made public what's really only known inside classified government circles about the level of exploitation against U.S. companies. You know, and they had identified over 140 U.S. companies that have been breached by this particular group, the economic loss of which really are, you know, haven't been fully tallied. But again, the NIA gives us an estimate of that. How much are they feathering their nest? Well, so much of what's going on is really at the direction of leadership in China, oftentimes through proxies, not just the military units, but proxies as well. And so much of it is to compete on a global scale with U.S. industries. So it's clearly part of China's strategy in global competitiveness.
So we're mixing the mercantile with the military. We're going to go to break now. When we come back, I want to talk about the range of responses, what the U.S. can do, what it politically can do, what the China, who is the China lobby, and what they're going to have, what their input's going to be. So let's go to break now, and don't go away. This is only going to get to be a hotter discussion.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
America is heading over a fiscal cliff. Home prices are still receding and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back, everyone. This is your host, Jay Revesz. We're at Global Reach, and I'm here with Dr. Anup Ghosh, founder and president of Invincia, and Alan Donaldson, the editor of American Economic Alert, and we are talking about the trillion terabyte topic, cyber risk, cyber security, cyber theft of intellectual property. So we talked about the why of it in the first segment, but let's talk about what the range of responses are. Alan, when we were talking before the show, you made a big point about mercantilism and about the approach that the U.S. government has traditionally been taken to China ever since the Nixon or even the Bush days of constructive engagement, trying to make China so integrate the economies that they will become a productive member of the world economic system and therefore less of a problem, less likely to engage in theft.
Exactly. Since the Nixon opening and certainly since China's economic reforms began in the late 1970s, early 1980s, it has been the main goal of U.S.-China policy to make China, and these are the words of a senior Bush administration official Robert Zoellick, to make China a responsible stakeholder in the world system, to convince China, to show China that it has an enormous interest in preserving a peaceful global status quo and open trading system, rather than seeing itself as outside that system, trying to challenge it or even to overturn it in some way. To me, this latest burst of news about Chinese cyber attacks is the latest in a series of Chinese policies that are saying loudly and clearly, this experiment is failing. And when experiments show signs of failure, they need to be considered. And so I would like the U.S. government to start a big top-to-bottom rethink of our current overall China strategy, because it ain't working.
Anup, do you agree with him? Is the U.S. acting on a mistaken premise when it looks at China?
Well, I'm not a China policy expert like Alan, but I do know cyber, and I will tell you a mistake that we would make is to get into an increasingly escalating battle on the cyber front with China. I am not a pacifist in the sense of we should keep taking blows and keep taking hits. Quite contrary, I think what we really need to do to put the pressure on China is to call them out every time they breach our corporate intellectual property in our government networks. So for too long, we've taken the approach of classifying information on the private side, of keeping it secret instead of disclosing it. I think the more we get it out there, this is what's going on. You should be outraged, and we need to step up our pressure on China and put in place sanctions against illicit trade. I think the better off we are.
Now, in your article, Cyber War, Trade War, you wrote about the dangers of escalation and blowback. What are those?
So I think a lot of people naively believe that if you're hacked, well, you simply need to strike back at where you're hacked from. Cyber attacks are slightly more complex. You're almost never, your attacker never attacks you from their network or from their machine. It's always done through a set of intermediary nodes, and it's very difficult to actually ascertain who's coming at you. So the immediate strike back is almost always a bad idea. And then even worse, you don't fully understand how capable your adversary may be. In the process of trying to strike back, you may escalate to a point where you cannot defend. And in a certain sense, the cure becomes worse than the disease. I think we have to be really careful, and instead really focus on attribution of who's actually attacking you, and go through traditional channels of both law enforcement and public policy to get the redress needed.
So it's more than just a sunlight cure. Alan, what kind of remedies would you propose?
I think we first need to get a much better handle on this problem. And when I say this problem, I mean the range, the wide range of highly provocative Chinese behaviors that we've seen for the last, and this is a somewhat arbitrary time frame, 4 or 5 years, in foreign policy, in the South China Sea, in terms of erecting new trade barriers to U.S. businesses, in terms of increased human rights crackdowns. Chinese behavior has not been what was expected or what was predicted, especially by cheerleaders for what I consider to be the reckless expansion of U.S. trade and investment policy and flows toward China.
Alan, who are those cheerleaders?
They are first and foremost the Washington lobbyists of big U.S. multinational companies and their Wall Street bankers who have pressed consistently for 20 years now for trade policies that have encouraged not only the offshoring of massive amounts of U.S. production and jobs to China, but for the massive transfer of advanced U.S. technology to Chinese business partners. So in lots of respects, this Chinese hacking problem was made in the USA by, again, reckless technology transfers that were conducted by U.S. multinational corporations. And their number one priority regarding U.S.-China relations right now is, as it has been for years, don't rock the boat.
I have a client who works with a lot of American steel companies who probably would say ditto and amen to that point. But can the U.S. disengage from China? The economies really are now very much dependent on each other.
In the world of politics and power, there's dependence and there's dependence. And the dependence situations, even if they're mutual, are rarely equal. And I would argue that fortunately, because this country has done such a great job of building up power and wealth, for its first roughly 200 years, we still have a major edge over China and major leverage across every field you can possibly think of. And we should think about ways of using it, but we should also be very mindful, much more mindful than we have been previously, of further integrating our two economies. And I'm thinking in particular of the Obama White House's active encouragement of Chinese so-called corporate investment in the U.S. This would be nuts, because the last thing that this country needs is more crony capitalism, especially from the world champion of that crony capitalism. And we certainly don't need a larger Chinese corporate presence in this country, because a larger Chinese corporate presence inevitably means a larger Chinese government presence. There is no bright line in China between public and private sectors. Quite the contrary.
Anna, from your ties with the Defense Department, do you see also either a need for a more of a disengagement policy or more of an integration policy? Where do you see things going on that end?
Well, if you talk to Department of Defense and certainly the White House, they will talk about the pivot to the Pacific. And really what they're talking about is reallocating assets out of the Middle East theater more towards the Pacific. And a lot of it is engagement. It's not war, it's engagement. And I think that's important.
Competitive engagement?
Pardon me?
Competitive engagement?
Department of Defense is about being competitive, but certainly engagement with our allies in that region, because as China's economy grows stronger, our allies are there, get more and more dependent on that economy. So having presence, engaging our allies is important. But the other thing I want to highlight, especially in cyber, is China's very quickly become you know, the universal bogeyman for, you know, the actor behind every exploit. And I think we really need to be cautious about that. It's too easy to point the finger at China. You know, almost never will you see the actual actor attack you from an IP address in their particular space. So we call them false flags in our business, which is when you attack someone and make it appear as if it came from someone else. And the verdict is out. I mean, clearly there's a lot of attacks here from China. I think the Mandiant APT 1 report was fairly convincing on that. But there are other actors in this space with significant expertise, including Russia, including Israel, including our allies in NATO, who have significant cyber capabilities. And let's not forget our own capabilities in space. So I think we have to be careful not to attribute every attack to China.
If I could make a real quick point here, Tay.
In intellectual property theft?
Well, go ahead, Alan.
I think it's very important to point out. I mean, of course we have to be careful. Who doesn't want to be careful? It's critical to point out that the executive branch still will not even identify China as a source of any of these problems. So I don't think our main problem in Washington certainly is a rash impulse to blame China for everything. In fact, it seems quite the opposite, an over-reluctance to pin responsibility on China when it is richly deserved.
So I would not disagree with that when it comes to the administration.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly in Congress, you'll see Congressman, Chairman of the House Intelligence Committee,
right,
Mike Rogers, is quick to point to China.
Right. Although, you know, what's really interesting,
and his Democratic counterpart.
The actual proposals that Mike Rogers have made are very modest. Information sharing, things of this nature. Let's put the main onus for cyber defense on the private sector. Those are hardly radical ideas.
And yet we're seeing the private sector being strongly resistant, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Well, they don't want to pay. It's expensive.
Anna, what are you saying? Because that's the business you're in, isn't it? Cybersecurity,
yes,
for companies.
So I fall in the camp of being very reluctant to have the government dictate to private industry what needs to be done in security. And let me tell you why. You know, I came out of the government space. I'm very well aware of the security on government networks being woefully lacking. They're no better than and worse than, in many cases, the security you find in private industry. So my position is the government should take the role of leader when it comes to security rather than a dictator, putting down mandates on private industry that of course, are unfunded. You know, I would much rather see the government be a leader where they take the right steps to secure government networks, which are constantly targeted, and lead by example.
Interesting. What two or three steps, if you were going to be able to say, adopt these policies today, what are the two or three things you'd have the U.S. government do to get started along these lines?
Is that for me?
Let's take it from the technical side, Anna.
Okay, sure.
Okay, so, you know, as far as technical policy goes, we have been stuck in the 1990s technology for a long time. And a lot of that goes back to the lack of disclosure. So when I joined the Department of Defense in 2002, just about everything that was going on as far as Chinese and Russian exploits was classified. The result being, we knew in 2002 about the exploits that are happening at that time for 4 to 6 years and are still happening. And my belief is because we never disclosed that in the public, the industry, the security industry, never evolved beyond mid to late 1990s technology, which we're still using today on our desktop. This is antivirus, it's your list-based techniques. So from a public policy failure when it comes to technology, it's really been the lack of full disclosure about what's going on in the networks that in turn has broken our system of innovation in the private sector. So we need to get back to innovating in security. There are new technologies that, again, the government should be adopting that can actually defeat many of the exploits we're seeing against these networks, but we're still stuck in 1990s technology.
I want to get back to what, you know, 2013 and 2020 technology we're moving towards. But, Alan, you had a really interesting article where you talked about dangerously short-sighted advice that Singapore's legendary founder Lee Kuan Yew is trying to give the U.S. What was that advice, and why dangerously short-sighted? Right.
Well, certainly, Lee Kuan Yew is an awfully smart fellow who knows a great deal about using power effectively. He stayed in charge of his country for literally decades and turned it into a very prosperous, very modern, very successful place, although not an extremely democratic place, to be sure. But Lee Kuan Yew has apparently given a series of lengthy interviews to two former senior American diplomats, and he's basically told them, here's how I think you Americans ought to handle foreign policy challenges going forward. And his point about China was, you need to figure out how to share power with China because you can't stop China's rise. The big problem with that advice, and I think Lee Kuan Yew knows this full well, is that power even within one country or one society is not easily shared. Look at what's going on in Washington right now. Power between countries, among countries, vastly more difficult to share, especially when you're talking about two countries whose historical experiences and values and social and economic structures are so radically different as are the U.S. and China. So I find this advice completely useless. And in fact, I think what Lee Kuan Yew is also urging America in a relatively, you know, diplomatic and extremely clever way is don't rock the boat. Keep U.S.-China relations on their present course. It's the only choice you have. I think, as the still stronger party here by far, we have many choices. We simply refuse to exercise them or even explore them seriously.
Dr. Ghosh, would you like to comment on that? We've got about 1 minute to break.
You know, I'm not familiar with the background on Lee Kuan Yew, but I will say, you know, one thing that helps keep China in check, one thing that helps keep the U.S. in check so we don't get into an ever-escalating battle on the cyber front is the fact that our economies are interlinked heavily. And I think that helps make for good neighbors. And there's a reason why China is unlikely to take out our critical infrastructures like banking and energy. It's simply because the damage that would be done to our economy would be really bad for China, where we're a major buyer of China goods. So I think there's a healthy check and balance on cyber war when it comes to China based on our interdependent economies.
It's a very interesting point. I wonder if some of the tension between the U.S. and China comes from our very different self-images and very different views of each other, by which I mean the U.S. believes it's the indispensable country, the only superpower. China has been the center of the world for 5,000 years and sees it's resuming its natural place. I wonder if that's kind of contributed to the kind of tension and rivalry we have now. Anyway, we're going to go to break. When we come back, we're going to plunge into ways you guys, the companies listening to this broadcast, can start to protect yourselves from such wonderful things as spear phishing. Don't go away.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Are you looking for innovative ideas on how to achieve your financial dreams? Tune in to Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday afternoon at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Join certified financial planners Ken Smith and Ethan Broga to learn how you can obtain financial success. You'll be entertained while you discover techniques to alleviate your financial concerns. Empirical Investing Radio every Thursday at 2 Pacific, 5 Eastern on the Voice America Business Channel. Need to hold focus groups in 7 countries or interview doctors in 57? Global Reach can get it done. Trying to expand into new markets, Global Reach will help you assess the opportunities, scope out the competition, and understand the risks. We are a strategic business intelligence firm with a network spanning over 60 countries. We can support your clinical trial recruitment campaign or identify the best practices to use when global branding. Founder and former editor of Business International, Tay Revez, brings 30 years of experience in helping companies from financial service to high tech to healthcare. She was cited by Super Searchers as one of the top 12 primary researchers within the U.S. Tay excels at in-depth interviews, custom multi-country studies, and out-of-the-box challenges. She's also been a featured speaker on subjects as diverse as baby boomers and co-branded credit cards. Let us help you with your next project. We'll work closely with you to define your needs and determine actionable solutions. Please contact us at globalreach-sbi.com or call 212-877-8616.
From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network.
You are tuned in to Global Reach with Tay Revez. If you have a question or comment about our program, please call in to 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or you can send an email to trr@globalreach-sbi.com. Now, back to the program.
Welcome back to the final segment of Global Reach, everyone. We are talking about cyber theft, cyber risk, and cyber security. And in this segment, we're going to look at cyber threat risk management. But, Alan, during the break, you were talking about tech transfer and what you think U.S. companies need to do and the U.S. government.
Well, it is currently and has been for quite a long time entirely legal for U.S. technology companies to train Chinese engineers and Chinese scientists in the most advanced aspects of computer science, networking, etc. In fact, just to give you one example, Cisco alone has set up 300 of its is on course to set up 300 of its networking academies in China alone. And the aim is to train literally tens of thousands of Chinese scientists. Now, if anybody out there thinks that they're not going to learn skills and master expertise that will be directly relevant to the kinds of cyber assaults we've seen, they must be smoking something. Of course they are. And ironically, Cisco has recently gotten burned by China.
It's interesting. Years ago, I interviewed Cisco, one of the founders, on how they became the industry standard for their industry segment. And they did it a lot through open source, through keeping everything open and creating as many stakeholders as possible.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like they're still acting in that vein. Now, Anup, you had a point, though, about the tech transfer and tech theft.
Yeah, I think a couple of things. One is, you know, we educate a lot of Chinese students. You know, you mentioned my bio, my affiliation I had with George Mason University. And I will tell you that you know, some of the best graduate students I had came from China. You know, a huge public policy mistake we're making as a nation is we're educating these graduate students. They're doing some of the finest research in science, technology, and engineering. And we don't give them a visa to stay here in this country after they graduate with advanced degrees. And we should do that. They go right back to China, really with this intellectual property in their heads, and go into the Chinese economy, essentially competing against us. So that's one issue.
Although, Anand, I must break in here. I'm sure that you have heard that very few Chinese students come here unless their loyalties are first checked very carefully by the Chinese regime. They're not very loosey-goosey about this at all.
And I will just add one other thing. We did a show 2 weeks ago looking at pre-K and global competitiveness, but there was a paper that was put out by Condi Rice and Joel Klein, which basically said human capital is going to be the determinant of power in the 21st century. And I think what you've both said is this human capital power might be the key to many of the problems. But you were going to go make a further point, and I think you were saying how companies had to be very careful about creating intellectual property in China.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, a lot of our multinational companies, including Microsoft, Cisco, Google, of course, have locations in China, and many brands, you know, that you haven't heard of. What these companies are finding out is China is systematically stealing intellectual property from these companies while they're in country as well.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there are cultural differences between how the U.S., you know, assigns and protects intellectual property and how the Chinese view intellectual property more as something to not be necessarily, something that's not necessarily stolen, but just captured. So I think there are cultural differences around that. To your comment around, you know, human capital, absolutely agree. If you look at the economic competitiveness on a global scale, what China is really playing is a long game of growing its talent, you know, from grade school all the way through graduate school. And they're putting out a core of engineering, math, and scientists that you know, dwarfs our output of the same in our country.
That's
a real, real serious concern for us.
I've just gotten word we have Tim Brauer, the managing director of SVP Deutschland, one of Global Reach's world partners. He's calling us from Germany. And can you put Tim on?
Hello, Tay. This is Tim Brauer from Germany.
Welcome, Tim. Let me introduce you to Alan Tonelson and to Anup Ghosh.
Hi there.
Good evening.
So, Tim, you polled a number of your clients to see whether any of them had experienced a hack attack. What did you find out?
Well, we had a conference the last 2 days, and I asked quite a couple of them, and nobody was aware of any hacking attacks. And basically they said, I don't know of any, but I'm not sure if we would know of anything if it had happened. And I did a little research about our newspapers, and they said that there have been quite a couple of espionage tries the last couple of weeks. There have been more than 1,000 IT attacks on the office of the Chancellor right before the G20 meeting. And our defense companies, you know, EADS, they build helicopters and that kind of thing. They have been attacked too, and also our steel producer, ThyssenKrupp, but they have been hacked in the U.S. So we cannot say that there is nothing going on here. Maybe our guys just haven't noticed yet.
Wow. Hacking is on the rise. What can our companies do to start to protect themselves? How do they start to create a capability to manage the cyber threat?
Yeah, so it's a great question. And you know, to Tim's point, at least in the U.S., we've seen an evolution where the very, very large companies were in denial for a while as to what was going on. And, you know, particularly over the last year, almost all of them now are looking for and finding the exploits on their networks, and I think you'll see that in Europe as they begin to look harder for these threats. As to what companies can do, we're beginning to see, with this growing awareness of the threat, on their networks, a drive towards innovation in security technology. We're seeing that every day more and more, where the large traditional security vendors that, you know, have been in place for a long time are no longer effective against these advanced persistent threats. So companies now are addressing this problem in two ways. One is they're taking more of a threat-focused approach to security versus what's been called a compliance-driven approach, where largely they're trying to meet audit standards and they're looking at vulnerabilities. The forward-looking chief information security officers now are really looking at their threats. Who's coming at me? What are their methods? And how do I adequately provision defenses against these threats to protect my assets?
Describe spear phishing, please.
So spear phishing today is the dominant form of how adversaries get onto corporate networks. And it's as simple as an email. Prior to launching a spear phish campaign, what an adversary will do is do research on the company, identify individuals that have a role. It's really easy to do with LinkedIn, Twitter, Facebook, and then craft an email that appeals to their interest. It could be an attachment in this email that's poisoned, or it could be a link they place in the email that, when it's clicked on, infects their machine. And once they got the target to open that attachment or click on that link, they then own that machine. It becomes a backdoor onto that corporate network. It becomes a beachhead to move laterally through the network, go look for that objective information, and then leak it, or what's called exfiltrate it to various drop sites.
So really any company is vulnerable, not just the large high-tech firms, but even the small tech startups, even the small companies with a manufacturing technology. How do you protect that? How do you get to make sure that your employees don't open you up to the sphere?
Well, to your point, Tay, every company is vulnerable, and the question is whether you become a target or not. You know, the conventional wisdom, which really no longer works, is you need to educate your employees as to the fact that they're being targeted by spear phishing, and educate them on the difference between a spear phish and a legitimate email. And it turns out that is just no longer effective, because these spear phish campaigns are so effective, employees really can't distinguish between a legitimate email from a colleague that they may have met at a conference, and a spear phish. So the where a lot of companies that we talk to in Vincia have realized is awareness training is important, but more important is putting in place technologies that protect users from themselves. So when they do click on a link, or when they do open an attachment, they're doing so in a safe environment, so that if it in fact does exploit vulnerability or runs malicious code, they're infecting a virtual environment rather than their actual desktop.
Does that mean open an email in the cloud? Let me just ask you something. Alan works with a lot of small and medium-sized manufacturers. Tim is working with a whole range of German companies, you know, from the small company to some of the biggest German companies there are. How do we help our respective universes, as well as the listeners of this show?
Who's going to start? Shall I start? I can say that during the last...
Seconds.
Hello?
We have 2.5 minutes left, and I need 1 minute at the end.
Okay. I can be quick. We have some of the big companies, they use only encrypted email. So... We have a slow startup process, because we have to deal with the IT company, with the IT department, and they insist on encryption. And so this takes a little effort to get things set up. That's the way they're doing it at the moment.
Alan?
I think there are clearly any number of steps that individual companies can and should take, including not setting up businesses and labs in China unless it's absolutely essential, and even then being extremely careful. But I would submit that as long as companies like, for example, Intel, keep saying things like, it's our goal with our China research and development strategy to close the technology gap in China, I don't think that should be America's goal, frankly, certainly not under this Chinese regime. And
Alan,
that's got to,
quick,
we have to be much more careful about this, much less
real
naive.
Quick, because we're out of time, what's your tweet? How can people follow your Twitter?
I'm at sign Alan Tonelson. It's real simple.
Okay.
Thank you, Tay.
Tim, how can they find SVP Deutschland?
Sorry, I didn't understand you.
The URL for SVP Deutschland.
Again, the line is so bad. Just finish up. I have a really bad line at the moment.
Okay.
I can't hear you.
It's www.svpdeutschland.de, svp.de, and I'll put it on the website.
Thank you very much.
How can they find Invincia?
You can find us on Twitter, at Invincia, Invincia. Our online presence is Invincia.com. And we address this advanced persistent threat problem by protecting your network from your users.
Well, I want to thank the three of you for coming on. This has been terrific. We are out of time.
Our pleasure.
Clearly, we're going to have to readdress this topic in the near future again. Now, in the meantime, I want to tell everybody next week we are going to take yet another crack at human capital and global competitiveness. When Charlie Cobb, president of French American Foundation, returns, we're going to talk about the perfect storm facing post-secondary education, unsustainable costs, scarce jobs, a world of rapid mega change. And he's going to be joined by the president of my alma mater, Goucher College, which is based in Baltimore, that is Sanford Unger. And together they're going to look at what universities in the U.S. and overseas need to do to equip their graduates for a world where your skill set is obsolete fast, where social dynamics and demographics are going through tectonic shifts, and somebody may have to have six or seven completely different careers in a lifetime. Do universities need to equip their students just to become engaged in the workforce or to become engaged citizens of a democracy? That's another important point. Mm. And would an updated liberal education, liberal arts education, in fact, maybe the best format for equipping us for innovation and rapid change? That'll be part of the heart of the debate. It's going to be a show for any listener, whether you're in school, sending a kid to school, job hunting, hiring, or just shaping your company for the future. So again, Alan, thank you so much for coming on
the
show.
My pleasure.
Anna, again, thank you. And Tim, thanks for calling us from Germany.
It was a pleasure, like always. Thank you,
Tate. Thank you very much,
Tate. Please use the next week to extend your global reach.
Thank you for listening to Global Reach with Tay Revez. Please join us again next Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Have a great week.